225. Whether hedonism, or pessimism, or utilitarianism, or eudaimonianism, the doctrine that life is the pursuit of happiness, all these ways of thinking, which measure the value of things according to pleasure and pain, that is, according to contingent circumstances and secondary issues, are ways of thinking in the foreground and naivety, which everyone who knows about creative forces and an artistic conscience will look down on, not without ridicule and not without pity. Pity for you, that is, of course, not pity the way you mean the term. That is, not pity for social needs, for society and its sick and unlucky people, with those depraved and broken down from the start, there lying on the ground all around us. Even less is it pity for the grumbling oppressed, the rebellious slave classes, who strive for mastery. They call it freedom. Our pitying is a higher compassion, which sees further. We see how man is making himself smaller, how you make him smaller. And there are moments when we look at your pitying with an indescribable anxiety, where we defend ourselves against this pity, where we find your seriousness more dangerous than any carelessness. You want, if possible, and there is no more fantastic, if possible, to do away with suffering. What about us? It does seem that we would prefer it to be even higher and worse than it ever was. Well-being, the way you understand it, that is no goal. To us, that looks like an end, a condition which immediately makes human beings laughable and contemptible, something which makes their destruction desirable. The discipline of suffering, of great suffering. Don't you realize that up to this point, it is only this suffering which has created every enhancement in man up to now? That tension of a soul in misery which develops its strength, its trembling when confronted with great destruction, its inventiveness and courage in bearing, holding out against, interpreting and using unhappiness, and whatever has been conferred upon it by way of profundity, secrecy, masks, spirit, cunning, and greatness, has that not been given to it through suffering, through the discipline of great suffering? In human beings, creature and creator are united. In man is material stuff, fragments, excess, clay, mud, nonsense, chaos. But in man there is also creator, artist, hammer-hardness, the divinity of the spectator and the seventh day. Do you understand this contrast? And do you understand that your pity for the creature in man is for what must be formed, broken, forged, torn apart, burned, glow, purified? For what must necessarily suffer and should suffer? And our pity, don't you understand for whom our reverse pity matters, when it protects itself against your pity, as against the most wretched of all mollycoddling and weakness? And thus pity against pity. But, to say the point again, there are higher problems than all those of enjoyment, suffering, and pity, and every philosophy that leads only to these is something naive. 226. We immoral ones. This world which we're concerned with, in which we have to fear and live, this almost invisible and inaudible world of sophisticated commanding, sophisticated obeying, a world of almost, from every way of looking at it, entangled, embarrassing, cutting, and tender. Yes, this world is well defended against clumsy spectators and familiar curiosity. We have been woven into a strict yarn and shirt of duty, and cannot get out. In that respect, we too are men of duty. Yes, we as well. Now and then it's true we dance happily in our chains and between our swords. More often it's no less true we gnash our teeth about it and are impatient with all the secret hardness of our fate. But we can do what we like. The fools and appearances speak against us. They are men without duty. We always have fools and appearances against us. 227. If we assume that honesty is a virtue of ours from which we cannot escape, we free spirits, well, we'll want to work on it with all our malice and love and not grow tired of making ourselves perfect in our one virtue, the only one which remains ours. May its brilliance one day remain lying like a gilded blue mocking evening light over this aging culture and its dull and dark seriousness. And if nonetheless our honesty one day grows tired and sighs and stretches its limbs and finds us too hard and would like to have things better, lighter, more loving, like a pleasing vice, let us remain hard, we final Stoics. And let us send her by way of help only what we have in us of devilry, our disgust with what is crude and approximate, our nitimur invetitum, we seek what is forbidden, our courage as adventurers, our shrewd and discriminating curiosity, our most refined, most disguised, and most spiritual will to power and overcoming of the world, which roams and swarms greedily around all future realms. Let us come to the aid of our God with all our devils. It is likely that because of this, people fail to recognize us and get us confused with others. What does that matter? People will say, your honesty, that's your devilry, nothing more than that. What does that matter? Even if they were right. Have not all gods up to now been like that? Devils who became holy by being rechristened? What finally do we know about ourselves? And that spirit which guides us, what does that want us to call it? It is a matter of names. And how many spirits are we hiding? Our honesty, we free spirits, let us take care that it does not become our vanity, our finery and splendour, our boundary, our stupidity. Every virtue tends towards stupidity. Every stupidity tends towards virtue. Stupidity all the way to holiness, people say in Russia. Let us take care that we don't end up becoming saints and bores through honesty. Isn't life 100 times too short to get bored with it? We'd already have to believe in eternal life in order to...